On this episode of Chicago Beer Pass, Nick and I have Phil McFarland joining us to talk about small bar, half acre, his plans next, and his opinions on running a bar in these pandemic times. All that and more on this week's episode. Here we are, hitting up events, drinking our way through Chicago beer, and trying not to miss a thing.
Yeah, because, you know, got a cork popped out, boom, it flies like fucking 10 feet. We're like, yeah, let's do it.
You know, all you have to do is add some fruit, stir it up, and ride that milkshake wave.
Whenever I see him, I gotta take a photo with the most decorated brewer in Chicago, Jonathan Cutler.
It'll be like the stuff you hear. You ever go to, every time you go to Floyd's, all the music sounds like this. Raw, raw, raw.
Sometimes you want a small beer, but really, you want a big beer.
You got to take in all those big aromatic hops.
Hey, what are you doing this weekend? Waiting in line for a bottle release?
You should have never been a fad. The black IPA is delicious.
Hey, welcome to Chicago Beer Pass. I'm Brad Chalisky.
Brad, what's up, man? I'm Nick White.
And we got a special guest joining us, Phil McFarland, who's been probably on many episodes of the Hopcast over the years, but the first time joining Chicago Beer Pass. So welcome.
Yeah, first time caller. Thanks for having me.
I know your beer journey goes way back beyond Nick and I's here. So great to talk to you. And it's been so long. I think we interact online and see your posts and what you're up to more so than actually running into each other these days.
No, that's fair. Yeah, I'm not out as much as I used to be. That's certainly true.
We all aren't, right?
Yeah, right.
Nice. Oh, cool. Well, since we're going to be talking about beer, Nick, what are you drinking out of your little solo cup there?
Red solo cup. I've got Hubbard's Cave Clean IPA. 7%. Can on 513.
Nice.
Fresh.
Not my jam. Oh. It's fine. You know, it's fine. Yeah.
I got this motorcycle sandals from Salamoth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's pretty tasty. New England IPA. Just what I need it right now.
Yeah. Right.
All right. So you got anything, Phil? Or you?
Yeah, I don't right now, but I have been loving that Half Acre Fader that they put out in April. That's a beer I've been excited about for a long time. So. Got a good bit of that in the fridge at home.
Nice. I haven't made it over there to pick it up. I think that was like maybe a weekend. This weekend, I might decide to go venture out and do some pickups.
Nice.
Yeah, I hear great things.
Yeah, it's just a tasty everyday brew, man. I love it.
Nice. Oh, cool. So, I said we got to start back at Small Bar Division, right?
Sure.
Like, I think that's where many of my craft beer adventures began in Chicago, at least.
Like, yeah, I feel like you guys were doing the Gents. Remember that?
Yeah. We had Gents for a while. That was just really a bottle share before that was kind of a big thing, but we were just...
I feel like that's how I got to know you guys, was through that, when you started venturing out to bars.
Yeah, and then we'd go to bars, especially places that had a good selection of beer, and in that time there wasn't that many. You know, you had Small Bar, you had Map Room and Hop Leaf, and just a few others kind of popping up, and you're like
6, 8, maybe 10 in town. Pretty tight list.
So how'd that adventure start for you, or how'd that venture, like, getting into basically a craft beer soccer bar?
Sure. Fair question. You know, I don't talk about this very much, but I came out of college, even in college, you know, me and my partner Ty and a bunch of our buddies, we were all DJs, and we threw parties in college. We came into the city and started throwing parties, and, you know, we had day jobs, regular day jobs. I worked in advertising, Ty worked for a magazine, but we had this side hustle, and it got to be a pretty big deal, and we got pretty deep into the nightlife and met a lot of people and a lot of owners, and, you know, sort of had this like behind the scenes understanding of how Chicago bar culture worked. And the woman that owned a club that we did a lot of work for had a restaurant that she wanted to sell on Division Street. Ty and I had been working on a business plan. We were actually, it's funny to think that we thought we were going to do this. We were 26, 27. And we had a business plan to open a hotel on Division Street. Whoa. In like 1999. We were real serious about it. And we had a hard time raising money for all kinds of reasons that are very obvious now. Ty went and opened the small bar in Logan Square. You know, he sort of scratched that hospitality itch in a different way. I held on to the dream of the hotel for maybe another year. And then this opportunity to buy this restaurant called Rambutan on Division Street, across the street from Mirai, came up. And Ty brought it to me. We actually talked about it the weekend after I got back from my honeymoon and decided pretty much that night that we were going to go for it and make it into another small bar location.
What and what year was that? Then did you guys open?
This would have been, we opened in September of 2004.
Okay, so the neighborhood was kind of just starting to turn a little. That was the Starbucks here. The Starbucks.
No, there was Mirai Sushi.
That's it.
John Mannion had a restaurant that I loved, and he's going to kill me for forgetting the name. Mas was in the space that is now Bangers and Lace.
Okay.
And Gold Star was there, Rainbow Club was there, right. And then a whole bunch of boarded up storefronts. There's a place called Leo's Lunchroom, Dynamite, kind of Greasy Spoon Diner. Very different streetscape back then. A lot of boarded up shops, a lot of empty storefronts.
Okay.
Now, Phil, the concept for this hotel, was the plan of have like a small bar in the hotel, or was this, were you focused? Can you walk us through how those morphed into?
I mean, we had a building on Division that's kind of across from Starbucks. It's been undeveloped. It just got turned into condos like a year ago. Beautiful building. And we were friendly with the guys that owned it. We'd been inside. We toured it, you know. And so the plan was to have more like a cocktail-y, sort of more high-end bar on the ground floor. I think we had a name for it. Hive, I think we were going to call it. And then it was like 20 or 30 rooms up top, a little more. I don't know. Are you familiar with the Ace Hotel?
Yeah.
So Ace Hotel came online in like 99, 2000-ish in Seattle, I think. And we were both like, that's pretty cool. And so it was kind of this idea to do like a Chicago-style Ace Hotel in Wicker Park.
Okay.
Was the gist. So it was not a beer spot. It was not a, you know, sports TV spot. It was, the idea was more of a cocktail lounge kind of vibe. And probably then, with DJs. I feel like we probably had that as part of it, but not like venue, more like background music.
Okay. And then, so when the small bar space happened then, was it just going to be an extension of what small bar, the other small bar was, or was it?
We felt like, you know, we had a menu, they had a food program they understood. They had this idea, you know, the beer idea at that time was about variety. Okay. And a lot of that variety lived in bottles. You know, I think we opened Small Bar Division with 12 taps and like 200 bottles, maybe.
Oh, wow.
Because that was sort of where, you know, if you wanted variety, it was in bottles. You weren't getting a whole lot of weird stuff on draft. Right. But at the time, variety, quote unquote, meant having Black and Voodoo Lager and Abita and beers that, you know, craft drinkers now would sort of turn their nose at. But, you know, we needed variety, and that was the idea. It was this enormous offering of beers. And at that time, we, you know, craft wasn't really a word, like microbrew, that was sort of in the dialogue and the lexicon. But we had two brothers, we had three Floyds. You know, I still remember popping the top on my first three Floyds Gumball Head Bomber, like a 22-ounce bottle of Gumball Head, and hops coming out, and, you know, the aroma, and it was just this, like I remember it very clearly, because it was kind of the moment where I realized there was this whole other thing going on. You know, we'd been drinking Budweiser by the bucket load up until then, and then, you know, hit this hard pivot of like, what's going on here? And that would have been, you know, like late summer 2004.
All right. So did you go in like already loving craft beer, or was it just like, we're ready to have a bar and we're going to have lots of variety?
I think we liked variety, we thought that was fun to have choices beyond, you know, six or eight beers. We thought that was sort of part of the appeal of it. And, you know, the soccer bit came in. That wasn't really a part of the program in Logan, but Ty and I were huge fans. And I felt like it could be, you know, one of our big challenges when Division Street was kind of deserted was just getting butts and seats. And we felt like we could make business in parts of the day that were slow otherwise by tapping into something we loved and kind of building this culture around soccer. And so that was, you know, basically we wanted to have a good time. We wanted a bar where our friends were comfortable. We wanted to have this sort of like fun exploratory environment with all these beers and show soccer games when the time was right. That was probably the extent of the menu. The concept, quote unquote, wasn't real fancy.
Nice. And then I feel like moving forward as the craft beer, I guess, worlds was starting to change. You were one of the first, I guess, I want to say beer bars to completely change the menu. Like decide that, you know what, chicken wings and artichoke dip isn't our thing.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the beer list started with, you know, Black and Voodoo Lager and all that stuff, but it had Gumball, had Bombers, and we had, you know, there was Two Brothers beer, there was Three Floyds beer, whatever craft you could get was part of that mix, but there just wasn't much. And then, you know, that slowly started to evolve, and I got a big shout out to Wes Phillips. He came into Windy City and started calling on the guy that was running our beer program at the time, Chad Lind, and he opened our eyes to Allagash White, Triple Carmelite, Quack, you know, a lot of these sort of classic beers that the Windy City portfolio was built on back in the day. Mm-hmm. And we started putting those things on draft and people started to respond. And we started to pick apart the bottle menu with like, this beer doesn't sell that well. You know, Wes was like, well, I have this other thing, you should try it. And, you know, so we brought in Cain and Abel and we dropped the SKU of Black and Voodoo Lager or whatever it was. And so the beer program kind of like morphed over time as more beer was available. We were more in tune with what was out there. You know, it was an evolution for sure. Mm-hmm. And that happened way before the food.
Okay.
The devastating lineup over at Windy City. I think maybe, I don't know, back then, hands down, probably the best beer lineup of all the big distributors was Windy City.
No question. I mean, before that, you know, like Stiegel was like an exotic beer, you know. People that would like turn their nose up at it now were pounding Stella because it came in that fancy chalice and they thought that was really cool, but it was Stella, you know, like it was just a different world back then.
Yeah. And the, you know, at its peak and like Brad was kind of alluding to, you know, you guys were ahead of the curve. You know, one of my first sit down beer experiences in the city was probably at Small Bar, right? Small mm-hmm. Bar Oplate, that era. Mm-hmm. And at its peak, the Small Bar concept morphed into these three different locations, which was mm-hmm. pretty cool. I didn't know the Logan Square one came first. And, you know, coming from, you know, I grew up in South Shore. So having a bar at the end of a residential block was like, was bizarro world to me.
Yeah.
You know, but it was pretty neat. But you got to three different concepts or three different locations. Mm-hmm. And then you decided to pivot. You said, hey, you know, I'm stepping away from this and then I'm going in a completely different direction from Small Bar altogether.
Well, I think, you know, the food change, there's a couple things going on. You know, by the time we got Small Bar Fullerton open was the same time that Ty Fujimura, my partner, I'm sure you guys, mm-hmm. Brad, I know you know him.
Yeah.
He was opening Arami mm-hmm. and sort of taking this fine dining pivot of his own. And, you know, I was trying to get the Small Bar Fullerton up online, keep Small Bar Division humming along, continue to compete and keep people interested in them and make news, you know, and that's where the food program came into play. It's like, well, we have this great beer and then we have this like kind of so-so food. It was good at the time when the menu came online, but as the market changed and taste changed, you know, our beer program evolved in a big way, but our food program was essentially the same thing we'd been doing for however many years.
Okay.
And I felt like it needed to kind of catch up to where the beer was. And so we used the two locations. We brought in this chef, Justin White. And yeah, it was a full teardown on the food program. Started with a brand new menu, brand new concept, brand new thought, brand new ingredients, brand new purveyors. I mean, it was a big pivot food wise.
Yeah. And did that had to have helped, I guess. It helped, I think, elevate the idea of also beer. At that time, we were all struggling with the idea of, is beer something you're crushing a 30 pack on the weekend, or is it something you want to like think about and talk about? So I think as the food evolved with it, it helped elevate the beer, which, you know, maybe we've all gone back a little bit and just like not caring as much, but
right, probably healthy.
Yeah,
might have all overcorrected a little bit there.
That's true.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that's fair. And I mean, the food change was tough at first. You know, there were a lot of people who were resistant to it. But over time, it proved itself out. The new food, you know, people found their new favorites. And the food we were putting out, I mean, man, I stand by it. It was exceptional. It was very good food for a quote-unquote bar. Mm-hmm. And at bar prices, you know, it wasn't like we suddenly had $30 entrees.
Yeah. Well, it's even hard now since your move and lots of places moved to find a bar that has, like, chicken wings and, like, just, like, classic bar food now, in especially yeah. the north side of Chicago. You're just like, I just want kind of gross food and drink some right. beer.
That's, get some tater tots, please.
It's hard. That's really hard to find that now, which yeah. That's good and bad. I don't
know. I mean, I think these things, you know, it's like this craft beer movement evolved, you know, bars came into fashion that were purpose-built to be American craft beer bars. Mm-hmm. You know, Fountainhead, Bangers and Lace, you know, that whole sort of era, that wave of beer bars were, you know, they weren't Map Room and Hopleaf vibe. They were built to be American craft beer bars with the aesthetic and, you know, the whole sort of clientele in mind.
Yeah.
And I think food went through the same kind of evolution. You know, this beer concepts changed, bar concepts changed, food concepts changed.
So yeah, then Nick was kind of alluding to your move then from those spaces to Half yeah. Acre.
Yeah.
What sparked that change? You just were, it was time, ready for something different, wanted.
Yeah.
You knew what the consumer wanted, but.
Yeah, I think, you know, we knew what people wanted. We knew what we could offer. We knew that the neighborhood was changing and that it was increasingly difficult to be the bar we wanted to be in the location that we were. I mean, that's just real. And, you know, the other reality is, you know, the physical space of small bar was pretty beat up. And, you know, we were staring down probably like a 90 or 120 day closure to like rip out and rebuild the kitchen and redo a bunch of stuff in the basement and, you know, like a deep, deep renovation. And, you know, the other X factor in all this for me was to do that, I got to borrow a bunch more money. And all of a sudden, you know, I'm sort of committed to this location and this business for another 5, 7, 10 years. And I just said at the end of the day, I wasn't ready to make that commitment.
Okay.
And so, you know, when I made that decision, it was clear that it was time to sell and move on. And that was the focus. You know, it took me about 18 months, 2 years to get it done. But I knew where I was headed for a long time. And then, you know, coming out of that, I'd spent a long time in marketing and advertising before hospitality. And I really wanted to get back to, you know, working with stuff people buy in boxes, I guess. I enjoy branding. I enjoy, you know, CPG goods. You know, I love it. And obviously, I spent a whole bunch of time in beer. I had a great network in beer. Craft beer was thriving. And it felt like a really great opportunity to apply some of what I'd learned as an entrepreneur in the hospitality space, running craft beer bars with things I knew about marketing, advertising, building brands, and, you know, see where that took me. So that was kind of the idea when I approached Half Acre.
Did you want it to be Half Acre when you, or were you just like, it could be anybody? Or were you like, I need it to be Half Acre?
No, I mean, you know, I wanted it to be Half Acre for sure. You know, when they announced the Balmoral Brewery, I pretty quickly got in touch with them. I hadn't announced that Small Bar was selling yet, but I knew my timeline and their timeline was pretty similar. And so I got in touch with Matt Gallagher and Gabriel and was like, hey, you know, I don't know what your plans are, how this is going to work, but as you grow, if I can help you, you know, I'd love to get involved. And we talked about it for 6 or 8 months probably before I finally started.
Okay.
But in that same time, I was doing some freelance advertising work at an agency in the city. I was interviewing for a number of different roles. You know, if you've ever been in a job search, you can't put all your eggs in one basket. So I had the one I really wanted, which was Half Acre. But I had to also have some backup plans in case, you know, for whatever reason that didn't work out.
Yeah.
So
what were some of the initial goals when you first got on with the Half Acre crew?
Oof. Figure out what to do with all the beer we could make at Balmoral.
Yeah. Because they were notorious for like not having enough beer to like leave the city, right? Like,
not even to feed the city, like, you know, leave the city, much less even just take care of the demand that was there already.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think, you know, the way I've come to understand the change for Half Acre was, you know, at the Lincoln Avenue location, they hit 15,000 barrels. They made every drop of beer they could there. They could not make any more beer. You know, beer takes the time it takes the space it takes. And they were in this, you know, sort of luxurious place where every drop of beer they made got sold. They could make anything they wanted. It would sell. And they didn't have to really, you know, it was just kind of fun. It was easy. And then when the Balmoral location came online, suddenly there's more capacity and, like, you have to be a little more thoughtful about, like, oh, well, we can make anything we want now. What are we going to make? When are we going to make it? Where are we going to sell it? How are we going to be sure we made the right amount to sell it, you know, fresh? And those questions that just had never been in the conversation suddenly were.
Okay.
And so that's kind of where I picked up, was just trying to figure that out. Like, what's this mean to have capacity now, and how do we use it well and keep doing the things that have made the brewery great and that are important, keep the beer fresh, keep it tasting great, but do it in a way that reaches more people.
I'm sure it helped too. Like they had like some core brands that are core offerings that were just like, if we can make more Daisy Cutter,
yeah,
it's going to sell. Like that was, it was almost Gumball Head in a sense. Like if we make more of it, there's a good chance like this is going to go by the
absolutely
game that it should.
And that was a piece, you know, when I first started, was figuring out how much Daisy Cutter we should make and getting our distributors reliably in stock so they knew they could sell it, get our sales team comfortable with, you know, if they get some new bar to pick up a handle, you know, they were nervous that the beer wouldn't be there and they'd get that phone call of like, where the hell's my Daisy Cutter keg? You know, so it started there for sure, figuring out production and how much can we make and how much should we make and, you know, sort of like slowly letting out those guardrails to fill more and more space.
Daisy Cutter is still, when anyone asks me my favorite beer, I'm just always, Daisy Cutter, it is always good, and if you can get it, like, it never, like, disappoints. Like,
yeah. I agree. And, I mean, you know, the ABV is right. It tastes great. You know, like, you're not worn out. When you finish one, you're ready for another. It's, yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So what were, as you were at Half Acre, what were some of those, I guess, offerings that, like, I don't know, you had to, like, convince people to get to, or, like, I don't know. The challenges that you saw as you were like expanding this like bigger brewery or like this bigger offering?
I mean, I think the biggest challenge was, you know, I think Half Acre wanted to be and has become and continues to be a pretty big brewery that still feels small.
Yeah.
You know, I think they didn't want to like throw open the floodgates and just feel like this big behemoth brewery throwing their weight around town and whatever. You know, they wanted to grow, but they wanted to protect that intimacy and that sort of like good, real connection between the folks that drank the beer and the people that made the beer.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and like Raj, employee number like 3, is still out there like cleaning tables and serving beer. It's like, dude, like you should be like, I don't know, somewhere else. But yeah, Gabriel,
he's like a, you know, living, breathing, you know, encyclopedia of Half Acre history. That guy, it's knows everybody, seen everything. It's amazing.
Because I feel like we see it everywhere, but I could, correct me if I'm wrong, Phil, but I feel like probably like Lagunitas, Goose, Rev, and then Half Acre, if we're talking like by volume in the city, is that right?
Yeah, some big gaps between those, but yeah, big spread between them. But I would say that's right.
But as they were making more beer, was it mostly like, I've been in, we were at Big North and all that.
You see
like the pallets of cans and all that stuff. Was there just more beer going out package wise, or was more of it going out like in the kegs and stuff now, especially, well, now we're, I mean, all packaged.
You know, I think our hope was always both.
Yeah.
You know, the you wanted to be growing your draft business, getting more bars to put tap handles up. But, you know, the grocery stores, liquor stores, convenience stores, you know, they sell a lot of packaged beer. Just volume wise, a lot of beer goes out that way. And so that was part of that balance of like, you know, how do we sell more beer in cans through these outlets that to date we hadn't done a whole lot with, while still keeping our cred and our cool that allows people to be excited about picking our beer up on draft for their bar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Having seen both sides of it and having been on both sides of it, you know, you've got the Michael Roper perspective, right? Where like bars are kind of like well, the breweries and their killer tap rooms are taking away from bars. That's how some people view it, right?
Yeah.
But it's all part of the same ecosystem. They all feed off each other. Like, what, seeing both sides of it, like, what's your perspective? Is this an evolution? Can they work together? Like, how should we view that dynamic between bars and tap rooms?
I mean, I think they absolutely coexist and can do so well. I see brewery tap rooms, and this is, you know, like the cynical side of me, and there's other people who probably see it differently, but really that's like a marketing experience. You know, like you're coming in and you're getting your most full live wire connection to whatever brewery that is. You know, their tap room should be the purest expression of whatever they're about. Mm-hmm. And I think breweries win customers or lose customers based on that taproom experience. And I think those customers, you know, if they're a Half Acre fan because they had a great time at the taproom, they are definitely going to drink Half Acre at bars. And, you know, I think it feeds the ecosystem by establishing breweries that people love and reaffirming why they love them. So that when they're out in the marketplace or at Soldier Field or at Hop Leaf or wherever they are and they can find a Half Acre beer, man, I had the best time. This crazy guy, Raj, waited at me. It was a blast. And they got Daisy Cutter here. That's awesome. I'm going to drink it again at this place. You know, I think that's the ecosystem that it feeds.
That's true, yeah. Like, I did find myself going to the tap rooms because, one, we have a podcast that talks about the beer, so we need to go there. But when I would go to the bars, I want to drink beer that I can't easily go to those tap rooms. But you also want those, like, when you see a list that has like 5 pages or whatever, you're like, well, give me that Daisy Cutter and then I'll find something else. So you like always need, like, so I think that's true. You need to have those good experiences where you're like, I know this is going to taste great. I love helping these guys or supporting them and they're safe. I don't have to think about this. I know what I'm getting. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do think they can coexist. And I think, you know, taproom experiences reinforce consumers' love or hate for specific breweries. And I think that carries out into the marketplace, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So now we're in this situation where these bars and these tap rooms cannot exist. Like, what was the news this week? The Three Floyds Brew Pub is done.
Indefinitely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they're going to reopen at some point, just not the first day that they can. I think they want to wait and do it safely, which I've got total respect for.
Yeah, I think that's a lot of businesses are, you know, we can, but we shouldn't, kind of.
Yeah, sort of a classic case, just because you can doesn't mean you should, right?
So now, but now that, like, that package good is becoming so much more important and just picking up in the store or, like, that experience, like, I drinking this Salamoth because, one, they deliver, and
right.
Because I've known them for years and I like them, so I'm not as likely to take a risk on a new beer in the current situation when I can't go and try something at a bar,
right?
So it's having that experience you've built or I guess cultivated over the years is so important.
Well, I think, you know, Daisy Cutter is a great example of that. You know, I left, we talked about this up front, but to be clear, I left Half Acre in November last year. So, you know, anything I'm talking about now is just opinions and ideas from the time I was there. But, you know, I imagine Daisy Cutter is doing really well for them right now. It's a beer you can trust. It's a beer you can get in a 12 pack, you know, so if you want to like load up the fridge and not have to go to the store again for a week or whatever. And in a time like this, I imagine Daisy's doing very well.
When you were running the small bars, did it ever come up in conversation at all to maybe start a brewery, a small bar brewery?
Did. Yeah. We actually looked at, I'll have to look up the dates. I was looking at it recently and it was pretty shocking. We tried to open a brew pub in a space in Lincoln Park, a small bar branded brew pub. And I want to say like 2008.
Okay. Oh, wow.
And again, just it was a pretty big space, you know, probably something kind of on par with Peace in terms of square footage. Mm-hmm. So it would have been tough. It was a big fundraise, and ultimately we weren't able to raise the money to do it. And then as I was looking at small bar division, trying to figure out, you know, and we sort of consolidated back down to the, you know, when the Fullerton location came out of the mix, we looked at doing, you know, we had that big parking space in the back behind the building. Right. And we explored excavating that, extending the dining room, making a rooftop, and putting like a 3-barrel, you know, little brew pub system in there. I was looking at that pretty hard in like 2012, probably. And I just couldn't make the numbers work. And I still, like, when I see people open with really small brew houses, I'm always like, huh. Between, you know, the construction, the equipment, and then the staff of, you know, like a full-time brewer to run the system and make the beer, I had a hard time getting those numbers to a place where I was comfortable with them.
Right.
And then we also, you know, I had a little bit of discomfort with, you know, knowing, basically I was afraid that if my math leaned too heavily on the beer that we made, and that's, you know, you make more money on brew pub beer, like Peace does well on the beer they make and sell on premise. I was afraid if I thought we would sell more of that than we could, that the whole model would kind of come unspun, if that makes sense. Mm. Like, I guess I didn't know how popular the beer we would make for ourselves would be when we had been so successful selling all these other breweries' beer.
Right, yeah. That's if you brew a couple bad batches, people are like, well, I don't want that. I'll take that.
Yeah, like, that's terrible. I'll go ahead and have the beer that I've been enjoying from you for the last 6 years or whatever, right? So, yeah, we looked at it a few times, a few different ways, and, you know, ultimately never did get it done, which I am, if I'm honest, totally at peace with. So,
yeah. You would have had to, at this point, especially in Division or in Wicker Park, own that building. Like, I can't, I'm in the area, so, like, the rent for all these businesses is just out of control.
Yeah, totally. We did own the building, which gave some comfort, but it was still, you know, to do all that construction, and, man, it was adding up, and there was just a piece of me that's like, I don't know if I'm ready to borrow this much money again.
Mm-hmm. And you had at that time, or probably around the time you were thinking of that, moonshine down the street.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You kind of got a firsthand model or a firsthand look at, like, is this doable? I don't think anyone...
Yeah, I forgot about moonshine.
Well, like, you know, I don't know that they ever really put beer out that they made. You know, they did all of that construction, and I don't think they ever made any beer or sold any beer.
Oh, no, I had their beer there. It was good, but no one cared. No one who was there wanted their beer. They did not care. They were there to get drunk.
Like, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess that, you know, that's sort of the spirit of what I was saying before is, like, I was just afraid that people would be like, why do I want a small bar beer? Like, that's
interesting, yeah.
I don't know. It, you know, it's easy to look back and pick it apart based on what beer became, but at the time it felt like just a crazy flyer, like, this is not going to work.
So then, now, like, yeah, you're saying you're glad it didn't work out. If you did have small bar still, or even thinking of opening a new spot or having a new spot now, like, what are your thoughts on this whole, I guess, beer, the bar scene, especially in Chicago at this point?
I mean, I think
drinks a lot.
Yeah. If I'm honest, and I've thought this for a long time, I do think, and, you know, like Mike Roper and some folks say it too, it's, you know, I think the hospitality scene is just overbuilt. There are too many bars and too many restaurants, and you can include tap rooms in there. You know, there's a lot of choices of all kinds. If you want to go out and get a pint, or if you want to go out and get a burger, I think there are more opportunities to do that than there are people who want to do it.
Right.
And I think that's been true for a while. And if I'm honest, that was a piece of why I got out of hospitality. It felt like there was just so much competition and only more people, bigger restaurants, better funded, coming online. And it felt, you know, kind of overwhelming. Okay. Stacked against me, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you have someone like Stephanie Izard's, their company, they have 4 restaurants that are very well funded, and you can't compete with that sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like there was a time in Chicago hospitality where, you know, if you didn't have like $1 million build out, don't bother. Mm-hmm. And that time, it makes me a little sad, if I'm honest. I go to cities like Philly and New York where they still have these kind of like pretty simple build outs, simple places, good bar food, good beer list. Feels great. and it's not all like lacquered and exotic woods and crazy furniture. And, you know, it's just like a decent place to eat and drink. I feel like Chicago has lost a little bit of that sort of simpleness.
Yeah, that's true. It's a drinking town, but yeah, I guess I never really thought about it. I mean, there could be too many places to go drink. I mean, if we're saying it, if I'm using my voice to say it out loud, I mean, I actually kind of agree with you. Yeah, there's a ton of options. Yeah.
And that's the experience. Then we're all going out for the experience more.
Well, and I think that experience also
drove a lot of competitive options. Yeah.
You know, like places that were hot for like 2 or 3 years. And then some other place was hot for 2 or 3 years. You know, that's also the range of options and the pace that they come online. I don't think has left us in a place where, you know, I don't know if we're going to see another like 25-year-old bar like the Hop Leaf. That's just like this granddad of Chicago bars. You know, I don't know that the city is set up to kind of allow for that at this point.
Yeah. Do you feel like he's done the right thing by just like getting rid of all? Is that what you would do? Just try to do growlers and get rid of all that beer you could possibly get rid of?
Man, I don't know how those guys are doing it. Every friend I've got in hospitality, my heart goes out to them. I think everybody is just doing the best they can with the hand they've been dealt, and it is very difficult.
Like Nick is running around to all these restaurants and places like buying bottles of whiskey that are like, hey, yeah, come and get this.
Yeah.
And you try to tip where you can. And that's the other side of it. Like, yeah, you're seeing some cool bottles, but on the other side of that cool bottle is a story of like, hey, you know, we had to change everything. And we're in a position we might not want to be in when we're selling this bottle. So you're reminded of it every time, mm-hmm. Even when you go support, you're reminded of it. You're like, yeah, this is, it's tough.
It is tough. And I feel for them, man. I really do. Everybody's just trying to figure out some way to survive until they can, you know, get back to some 50% normal mm-hmm. situation. And I think for a lot of bars and restaurants, you know, operating at 50%, like, that's tough. It's really tough.
Yeah, I think I saw something the other day. It's like, you don't really make that much money. You have to be at like 80% and above most of the time mm-hmm. to even like break even. So,
yes.
What do you want to...
You know, Chicago rent being what it is and cost of goods and labor and all those things being what they are, like, no, there are very few hospitality businesses that could succeed and thrive at, you know, 50% of their old revenue.
Man. So what do you see then? Have you thought about what the bar scene looks like moving forward? If we don't magically have some sort of vaccine here in the next, you know, as Trump tells us by September. So.
Right. We'll see where that goes. I've read so many, you know, X, Y, Z will never be the same as it was. You name it. How you buy t-shirts, where you get your beer, how you buy cheeseburgers, whatever. You know, the media is full of all of these things will never be the same. And I don't know if that's true over the stretch. I don't know if anybody really does. But the thing I've been thinking a lot about for hospitality is just how, you know, as they ease back into getting open, I think a big challenge in reopening hospitality is that people, like, you can open your doors. That does not mean people are going to rush in and fill the seats and, you know, just sort of pick up where they left off. And so I think the piece I've been thinking a lot about is how can you, as you reopen, really clearly communicate changes you've made in how you operate, what your new standard procedures are, how are you keeping clean? How have you reconfigured your space? What are you doing that I can really easily see? Like, it's obvious to me as a customer when I walk in that you guys have taken this seriously, you got a good plan, and most importantly, you're working your plan. So that's been a lot of what I've been thinking about is, you know, what are those plans? What's it take to operate? And how can you do it in a way? It's almost like it's not enough just to do it. You have to do it in this sort of very visual, easy to understand way for consumers so that they're like, oh, I see that. Yeah. I feel better. I will sit here and work here.
Especially honestly, someone who's doing marketing or from that world, like, you have to market your changes, right?
Your new hygiene practices or whatever you want to call them. I do think people are going to need to see that you've taken it seriously. and see that you have a good plan and see that you are working your plan to feel good about coming back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're gonna.
I think if they come in and they have a weird experience and they're like, oh, I guess we'll try. Let's try our neighborhood bar and see how they're doing. And they go in and it's just like, yo, you guys haven't done anything. You know, I don't know that they're going to have as quick a track back to, you know, their original base of regulars that they maybe had before all this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could be wrong. This is just my own speculation.
I think we'll make choices on, you won't go out for like, oh, I want to go out for a burger. You'll decide like, oh, what's the safest place to go to tonight? Mm-hmm. So.
Totally. Who's done a really great job of, you know, retooling how they operate their restaurant that makes me comfortable going? Will probably, for me anyway, will be a bigger determining factor than, you know, anything.
Yeah, I know. Nick, you too, you're out there with your face shield on and stuff at these places. You're above and beyond like most people, so.
Yeah, man, I'm disappointed in humanity, you know. I just saw safety first. I picked up beer from Brad's place today. I had on a shield and gloves. And I would personally like to see more people, regardless of how it makes them feel, more people that are selling a product of any kind, just kind of, you know, rock the gloves, rock the mask. You'd be surprised how often you don't see retailers rocking the gloves and the mask. It's, you know, I'm just
gonna stand. That's what I'm talking about. I mean, I think there will be, and some people clearly don't care and won't care, but I think there's, you know, 60% more of consumers, especially in urban areas, who are gonna, you know, whether or not you're wearing gloves is gonna matter.
Yeah,
they won't notice.
Even if you've used those gloves to do something else, I just want to know that you thought about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a visual acknowledgement that, like, yeah, this is weird, and we're doing our best. You know.
There you go. Yeah, what you said.
Yeah, I think that's important. So I don't know how people will do that, but I, you know, when I think about going back out, I know that if I walk into a restaurant and I can tell they just haven't really changed anything, I'm going to be kind of sketched out. And I probably won't go try that place again for a while. Yeah. You know? So we'll see.
Well, man, yeah. Philly, you've seen the beer scene, yeah, evolve quite a bit over the last couple of decades. So it's awesome to catch up and, yeah, I don't know, get your perspective on that, even where it's going. So it's cool.
Yeah, anybody's guess on that last part, man. I don't know. There's piece of me that wants to think that even the beer scene and how people drink and what they drink will be different after this, but I don't know. Maybe not.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I've had some pretty fun times in all your joints, man. I can remember, you know, whether it's like a girl's pine out, hanging out, insisting we hang out at a small bar, or, you know, Brett Porter waxing poetic over like a 6-year-old bottle of Juliet, you know, mm-hmm. Those being in neighborhoods that I had never been to before. Experiences I never had before. Those are at your joints. And it was only fitting that when Half Acre decided to expand what they were doing, that, oh, look, Phil McFarland is there to help help this situation grow. So it's always been cool. So that catching up and kind of revisiting some of these experiences has been, you know, given us some sense of normal. So that's cool. And I appreciate you hanging out with us, man.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it, man. It's nice to talk about old times. I don't go down those paths all that often. And sometimes it's kind of fun.
And we had Jesse on, and, you know, we were talking about Mambacu days and like small bar and like all those burger things.
He got some new thing going. What's he doing now?
He's at Corridor and Crushed by Giants and all those kinds of things. And then he has his Feast City.
Yeah, that's what it is. Feast City. That's what I was thinking of. That's this new thing he started, right?
Yeah, like high end food rather than just meat, beer, and rock and roll. You know,
stacked with bacon and sauces.
Yeah, he wants some better food sometimes.
That's fair.
As we all do.
We're all a little older, you know, a little fancier tastes.
Meat, beer, rock and roll, and whatever you call that pig face thing that they always serve at beer dinners, right?
Yeah. I used to know the name for that thing, but I've forgotten.
Yeah, pig jaw or something. It's got some fancy name to it. Yeah.
Never ate one. The cheek meat is good, but the rest of it kind of freaks me out. Nice.
Well, yeah, I think Nick and I both are excited to see what you do next. Phil, and I'm sure people be interested. You're always sharing a lot of like good articles on LinkedIn about like the beer, I guess, scene and the consumer products. So it's always fun to see and get a little sense of that marketing.
Yeah,
side.
I mean, even though I'm not in it day to day, I'm still, you know, reading up and staying sharp and seeing what's going on. So
cool. Well, I'm sure. Is there a best place that people can find out when you're going to do something, Twitter, or is it LinkedIn, or you're going to announce something, you think?
I don't know if my next, whatever I do next will be announcement worthy, but LinkedIn, probably, yeah. I am doing consulting work now. You know, that was kind of my big, I guess, quote unquote, LinkedIn announcement a couple months ago. I've been doing a lot of freelance work in beer, spirits, beverage of all kinds, really, CBD, cannabis. Nice. Yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, we're going to talk with Bob Egan about the kombucha.
He's a hard kombucha.
Yeah, he's with Juneshine. So how are you liking that scene a little bit?
A piece of me, having been in and around beers and bars and music and like for so long, I'm kind of ready to not drink as much. Mm. And a lot of what I'm looking at in the future does not involve alcohol. Okay. So I'm interested in kombucha that doesn't have booze in it, yeah. Personally. It's like a wellness thing that you can consume and, you know, sort of be social and hang out. But I've been drinking a lot less and sort of finding ways that I can socialize and still modify my mood somehow, but maybe not with alcohol.
Okay. Nice.
That's where my head's been lately.
Cool.
If I never have another hangover again. I don't know. You guys may not know this about me, but I am notorious for terrible hangovers. Oh. And I'd be just fine if I never had another.
I feel you there. Oh, cool. Well, Nick, then where can people find you or... you know, if they want to see you in your face shield.
right on, man. I'm on Twitter at Nicosio.
And I'm on Twitter at Brad, although we are not going anywhere or posting very much. You know, we still got the podcast we're doing. We got some fun guests coming up. We got a Tom Corder, like I said, Bob Egan. And nice. Yeah, just.
I haven't talked to Tom Corder in a while. Tell him I said hi.
Will good do. Dude. Yeah, always sent us some Penrose beer. So excited to dive into that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
See what he's up to. But. That'll do it for this episode. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.